This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. For those of you that are already on YouTube, you can see there we have a special guest. But of course, I've got to go to the main man, which is the co-host of this Twin Peaks Investing Podcast, which is Henry Viola Hare. How are you doing, sir?
I am very well, thank you, Peter. Nice to be back with you. And even better to have our exciting guest with us today.
Absolutely. I'm not going to waste any more time. We have got Wayne Grossman, been in financial services for approximately 38 years, been a trader at Citibank, Rothschilds, UBS, Deutsche Bank. We've got a lot to cover, folks. We're going to cover so much of his journey, from a humble little student to a man about town and the city and across the globe. So where do we start here with this? I think the best thing to do with this, Wayne, is to firstly just give us a little bit of a background from a young lad.
It was actually Preston Manor School, which is in the northwest London suburb of Harrow. So I grew up in the London suburbs. I was a complete loss what to do with my A-levels, which, to be honest, exams never came naturally for me, but I needed some motivation to get through the exam. So I was due to take up a place at the City of London Polytechnic, as it was at the time, to do a foundation course in accountancy. And I would hope that anyone knows me would actually look back in horror and think, what would this guy ever have done or become as an accountant? It really wasn't for me. And there was an advert in the, I think it's a Daily Telegraph, believe it or not, when jobs were still kind of put in the classified. I remember reading this advert. It says, domestic and international metal traders and brokers required. I thought, that sounds interesting. So I've gone for the interview. And the one takeaway I remember from that interview, other than the guy saying, well, you better travel the world, be able to do this, was there was a trade magazine on the counter called Metal Bulletin. So I made a mental note. But when I got back, the next day I've gone to the local news agency to try to order a copy of the Metal Bulletin, to be told you can't. It's a specialist subscription magazine. And from that, I was hooked. This was a club that I wanted to get into. Only those in the know could buy this magazine. And it was like that red velvet rope when you're 22 years old, you want to get in somewhere and they won't let you in. How do you get in? And that literally is how and why I became a trader in the world of commodities, because I couldn't buy that magazine to see what was going on. It was the dullest magazine in the world, by the way, but that's neither here nor there.
Brilliant, brilliant. So first job then, commodities markets, the base metal traders, but you're not actually doing it in the UK. What happens then?
Commodity trading at the time, which this is probably, again, not the best bar for someone in the world, there was no regulator. So as shocking as it sounds, you could take as much of a turn from a client order as you could get away with. And I know that in today's world where the FCA stamps their approval on every single trade, it's actually a shocking concept that there is no regulator. But back then, the commodity markets were the wild, wild west, literally. You just did whatever you thought you could get away with. And so the broking firm I worked with, they actually sent me to New York fairly shortly after I'd arrived. So age 20, I pitched up in New York at 8 weeks after I joined the firm, literally with no survival skills whatsoever. I couldn't sew a button on a shirt. I didn't know how to cook. My parents thought, don't be ridiculous. When they said, you'll go to New York, they thought the firm was just saying that to get me there. 8 weeks later, I'm there, unable to do anything. I was literally possibly the most hopeless 20-year-old in the world for self-survival. But I had TV meals and somehow I managed. I'm here today.
You've covered it there, but, you know, I think Henry's definitely been there and I've definitely been there, where you're in a completely new environment and everything's just gone at a speed of knots, and you're 20, 21 years of age, and you're going, what is going on? Who is there for a young Wayne Grossman going, look, I'll show you the way? Who was there in your 2 years to try and help you out there?
So in New York, I was working for a subsidiary of Standard Chartered Bank. So it's, if we drill down, Standard Chartered Bank owned Mercator and Goldsmith. Mercator and Goldsmith were one of the five precious metal members of the Goldfix. They owned a commodity broking side called the Commercial Metal Company. So it's a subsidiary of a subsidiary of Standard Chartered Bank. So whilst there was only three of us in the office in New York, there was the comfort of someone at Standard Chartered Bank knew who we were. If something went wrong, they would sort it out. So perhaps, obviously, they weren't going to sew a button on a shirt for me, but for example, my apartment got broken into once when I was out there. I told my line manager in London what had gone. Within a week, I've got the money back from Standard Chartered Bank, because they weren't insured. So I wasn't perhaps quite as helpless as I would suggest. But there were interesting times trading commodities in New York for 2 years.
Brilliant. Okay, so we're going to cover more about the commodities later on, but I was just going to carry on the chronology of this. So after 2 years, you returned to London. You took a job with NM Rothschilds trading silver. So you're continuing the commodity side of it. And it was during this time, we need to explore this little bit of element of the story regarding the Nelson Bunker Hunt time and the all that went on there and the monies and the escalation and the rapid rise in prices.
So, I mean, obviously, nothing to do with me. Well, I don't think the Russians invaded Afghanistan because I'd gone to Rothschilds, but I think the Russians invaded Afghanistan in the autumn of 1979, which is probably a month after I joined Rothschilds. And that also coincided with Nelson Bunker Hunt on the corner of the silver market. So, I mean, I can quite honestly say in my almost 40 years of trading, that period of trading was the most exciting and, looking back, the most unbelievable, because we've gone from making, I don't know how much money the Rothschilds trading desk made at the time, but I would say we were making some days 100 times in a day what we were making previously in a week, because prices were moving dramatically. We were the center of the gold trading universe in Europe, and accordingly also we were the main silver trader. So it's just phenomenal times. We were doing, I'm gonna say, 400 trades a book per day, which is a huge number, maybe even more.
That sounds extraordinary. And of course, the bonuses were coming in when you were being rewarded for those as well, yeah?
Really? I mean, if we just jump forward a little bit. I
asked that because I'm thinking about the loads of money era. That must have been around that sort of time, or was it a bit too early?
No, this was too early. I left in 1981. Okay. I was earning £9,000 a year.
Okay.
I went to a job with an American company called Mark Rich, who was subsequently broken up into Glencore and Trafigura, which were two huge companies. Wow. And they paid me £25,000 a year salary. So I've almost tripled my salary by leaving. So the money wasn't in trading back then. Without a doubt, the power and the money was with the employers, not the employees.
Okie dokie. I'm gonna allow get Henry on here to just ask you some questions about the commodity side of it, because he's fascinated with it all. Go on, Henry.
I am. I mean, first of all, great to have you on the show, Wayne.
Thank you, Henry.
I mean,
thank
somebody
you.
With your pedigree and your history, it's just great to have you here and ask you some questions. I mean, I think most of our audience are traditionally equity investors. So we understand equities, we understand debt markets. What makes commodity markets different from those? How do they work? What are they?
So commodities are traditionally broken into two, maybe three subsets. You've got soft commodities where you've got the big agricultural traders like Cargill and Dreyfus. And if anybody's interested in that side of things, there's a book I'd recommend called The Merchants of Grain, which I read back then when I was at Rothschilds. Fascinating book onto these into these five companies who dominate the world's food markets. And then you've got what's known as non-ferrous metals. So non-steel is, it's a commodity. Steel is steel. It doesn't trade. Someone produces steel as an RSJ or whatever, and they sell it. It's not a tradable commodity, really. So the main non-ferrous metals are lead, zinc, tin, copper, and silver is included in this. So silver was, I think it still is, traded on the London Metal Exchange as a future. So the London Metal Exchange is only futures, which means you're trading for a date in the future. So if you sell it, i.e. go short, it was 3 months ahead. You had 3 months to buy it back at a lower price, right? Or you lost money. And then at Rothschilds, we were physical bullion traders. So not that anybody ever, not that it was ever delivered to the office, but it's what's called spot trading, which for 2 days forward settlement. So that's where all the excitement was. Gotcha. Back then.
So I'm guessing when you started out, you weren't running around with a wheelbarrow picking up gold bars. Not quite like that?
No, not at all. I mean, the only time I actually saw what we were trading was I went to the New York offices and, my couple of jobs later when I was at Citibank, they showed me around their vault. And I saw, obviously not actually in it, but behind the bars, behind the bars. It was almost like, I couldn't work out who was behind the bars, me or the commodities. But there was, I don't even know how much ever it was, but that's the only time I've actually physically seen what we were trading, which was a huge amount of gold in Citibank's vaults.
Gotcha.
Exciting times, though.
Yeah. And what do you think it is that people that don't work in commodities markets most commonly misunderstand about them?
I think the whole concept of futures for a lot of people is not complicated, but it's shrouded in mystery. The fact that you can sell something you don't own, the fact that you've got 3 months to... And I've tried to explain to friends, maybe I'm just not very good at explaining things, or maybe it is as dull as ditch water, but I've never actually had anyone I feel say, oh, now I understand what you did. So I think it's the whole futures system confuses non-traders.
Yeah, gotcha. I mean, most equity traders that listen to this podcast probably don't deal in derivatives.
Maybe index futures, I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's probably it, yeah.
So, yeah, okay. And are there particular indicators that you need to watch when you're dealing in futures and commodities? Are there things that you're tracking as a trader?
That there are so many things that actually affect what the markets do. Obviously, the main one is interest rates, because interest rates affect everything. The strength of the dollar affects gold futures. Gold futures affect silver futures. And it all just kind of trickles down from there. So a lot of futures traders, and I've never been a futures trader, but a lot of futures traders will watch the T-bill markets in Chicago to get an idea of where the dollar might go, which ultimately will affect where gold goes. Because gold is always traditionally seen as a hedge against inflation, and thus they look at anything that could affect inflation, main of which would be interest rates. So
yeah,
low interest rates, more chance of inflation, gold should go up. And of course, the cost of owning gold is less when the interest rates are low.
Gotcha. And what was it? Could you describe a typical day for you at Rothschild? What was it like working there?
I think I was 21, 22 when I started there. And it literally exploded 2 months after I'd been there. So it was perfect timing, because I knew what we were doing as bullion traders, who we made markets to, who we didn't, how the trading worked. And then all of a sudden, it's like a probation period. Then all of a sudden, everything just exploded. And there wasn't time for anyone to explain anything to anyone. We would literally be on the phone. There'd be call after call after call every minute of the trading day. It was just staggering, the volume of trades we went through. It was probably... two or three of us on the silver book, two or three on the gold book. Then we had a telex operator, because trades were done over telex back then. And we probably had four or five other people in the room just answering phones, shouting out kind of a price for Swiss Bank Barl or whoever. So it was
Gotcha.
crazy
So
times.
fast-paced, and I
Massively
imagine
so.
pretty exciting for a young 20-something.
It was unbelievable. But I actually genuinely think that was the peak, and I know, God, this sounds terrible. That was the peak of my market reading ability. I mean, when I look back, think back, what I did. I mean, they end up calling it an early morning punt. I used to get in before anyone else, and I would basically have a punt. And I'd like to perhaps suggest it's slightly more informed than just a punt on silver. So by the time everyone else was in and the markets had opened, I'd already traded silver in Hong Kong, and I'd either decided I fancy going up, so it was going down. And I every day came in, they already had a position because traditionally we went home with no book. But they came in, and there I was at 21 years old, basically trading before anyone else got in, which worked. Yeah, great times.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So after, so you moved to your next firm. Where did you go after that? What was next on the roster?
So, as I said, I think I was at the peak of my trading abilities. And to be honest, I think employers probably also had the same view that in a 21, 22, that is, you're certainly mentally as sharp as you're ever going to be, because it's probably downhill cognitively from them, if not experience-wise. So I went to this Mark Rich company that subsequently became Trafigura and Glencore for almost triple my salary. And I found out that when you get into bed with the devil, what happens, which I'm sure you don't need me to explain, but they're expecting me to take calls at 10 o'clock at night. And after 10 months, I just thought, not for me. It's all the money in the world doesn't make up for no quality of life. And I knew Citibank were setting up a gold desk. So I've contacted the guy and I've joined Citibank. And now, I've come from a decent salary at this Mark Rich subsidiary, and I've got a company car, which, to be honest, as a 22-year-old, it was the greatest thing on earth, getting someone else to buy me a car. And I've now gone to Citibank, similar salary and a new company car. But unfortunately, the treasurer who was ultimately responsible for my hire at Citibank was promoted 3 months after I started, and that was the end of the Citibank and silver trading desk. They didn't know what to do with me, and
Wow.
they Sorry, I was going to say they put me on. They wanted me to be an interbank FX trader. I don't know how much you guys know about interbank FX, but Citibank are the number one FX trader in the world, and they forced me to do it. I didn't want to do it. I just thought, I've had enough. Pay me off, let me go, and I'll find another job. But they thought they could make me a foreign exchange trader. I think I'm fairly safe in saying I was the worst interbank FX trader Citibank have ever employed. I didn't want to be there. Ultimately, they didn't want me there. It was just a really, really bad time. I didn't enjoy it. With hindsight, the fact that I had possibly one of the most coveted jobs in London trading forced upon me, yeah, big
You
shot.
didn't want to be
So
there.
basically, mentally turned it down, physically, I'm there. Perhaps I should have stuck with it. But either way, me and Citibank was not a good mix. So myself and Citibank was really not a very happy time for either of us, I don't think. And I left to join Holco. Holco was a metal broking subsidiary of ED&F Man. And whilst I was there, I don't know if you know the story of what happened with the International Tin Council. The International Tin Council was a cartel. It was a UN-funded body that ensured that tin maintained a price for developing nations such as Malaysia that were producing tin. So the International Tin Council, UN funded, was creating a false market. To cut a long story short, the UN or the sponsoring bodies pulled the plug. The International Tin Council basically pulled out the market, owing companies tens of millions of dollars or pounds. And the company I was working for, we've now lost equivalent like 3 years' money through one client. It was fairly obvious that it was never going to survive. And I, luckily for me, the stock market was looking for a cheaper route to get traders. So established jobbers, as they were on the floor, were this was 6 months before Big Bang. So this was kind of spring of 1986. The traditional jobs on the floor had become very sought after commodities as Big Bang, which was, you know, the allow firms to operate in dual capacity, stockbroking firms now wanted traders. So the existing traders were very expensive, and a slightly cheaper route was taking commodity traders in and retraining them. And that's exactly what happened to me. I joined UBS Phillips and Drew for 6 months on the floor before Big Bang. And then I was a market maker for Phillips and Drew for 8 years.
Wow. So we need to talk about this, the myths around market traders. And I need to just jump on with that, because we've had some market makers and I've interviewed a few of them in the past, but they all tell a different tale as to what the actual work entails and the frenetic nature of it. And, you know, so what stories do you want to share from your time, brief time, as a market maker, please, Wayne?
Well, no, I was a market maker from 1986 to 2003. So I stayed.
Wow,
So it was a stock market. So the first thing that struck me as something I couldn't get my head around. I've come from, you know, Rothschild's bullion book, where one person does the gold book, one person does the silver book. Maybe there's two. Citibank, there were two per currency. So the spot dollar market, as it was pre-euro, was two people. And then there was another two, one guy doing Japanese yen.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
I've got to the stock market, and these guys, these jobbers, are making a price in up to 150 different instruments. It was beyond my comprehension how you can keep track of, you know, from the world, from the uniform, sorry, not the uniform, from the uni trading, whatever, basically trading one single instrument. I've come to this world where people are trading, making a price in 150 different instruments, albeit they were defined by industry. So you wouldn't be making a price in J. Sainsbury's and Vodafone. You know, you would do the food retailers, or you would do the engineers. I was just staggered at, and I thought to myself, these are the best traders in the city, just by the sheer fact the number of instruments they're making a price in. So that I found very difficult at first to get my head around. And it became kind of more cohesive the longer I did it. I'd like to think I was a pretty decent market maker.
Cool. Okay. We've got some questions around the trading strategy then regarding that, and the psychology of it all, right? These are some questions that Henry's put together. So
thanks, Henry.
For you, given that wealth of experience, I'm looking at it now, you're saying almost 17 years as a market maker, if that's correct, right? What separates a successful trader / market maker from an unsuccessful one? What is it with carrying all that information, the dynamism of it?
Oh, one of the biggest, if not issues, but one of the biggest challenges was remembering what's called a limit. So a limit is something either a client or a stockbroker, which may well be for another client or for an individual, would leave with you. So if we let's say inch Acme whatever is £2 to £2.05, and a client will may leave a limit. I want to see an offer. He wants to buy Acme at 193 if he gets there. Now it might take, it may go up. But it doesn't matter when. He still expects us to show him an offer at 193 if they get there, and that's what's called a limit. So one of the biggest challenges was remembering limits. We'd write them in a book, but of course, when you're busy, you don't have time to look in a book all the time. So that was always a challenge, keeping on top of limits, limit orders. I'm sure there's an electronic notepad or some way of doing it now, I would hope. But back then, booking a trade was a small nightmare. But anyway, so limit. Yeah, and also one thing some brokers were known as warm. Do you know what I mean? Okay, so by that I mean they would show us the way, because they had clients who were in far, who had far greater knowledge of events than we did. And they were the stockbrokers, and they were the clients that we wanted, because you do not want to be the last one to see that order. You want to be the first. So as a market maker, you wanted to make sure that the stockbrokers and the clients that were known as warm came to you first, because you were the fastest and you made the best price. So we it's ridiculous. We're almost paying for orders then by giving them a better price than they should have had, but we've just to get them to come to us. That makes sense.
I fully understand that. So with regards to that then, and you talked about it being non-computerized mainly then when you were working with it and having to go back into your notebook, what is the biggest loss you've ever experienced, or what did it teach you regarding some of the stuff? You're balancing your books each day, aren't you, as a market maker?
So we were balancing the books, in as much that the starting position and the purchase and the sales had to then equal the closing position. We booked things. The first 6 months we kept what was, well, it was a giant book, about that big hardback book, and we kept all our trades in. I don't even know what we called it, but once I got to UBS, Phillips and Drew after the big bang, then it was done computerized. So it was virtually impossible to have a flat book, because as a market maker, if I've sold 1,890 shares to someone, I'm never going to be able to buy that exact amount back. So we had a book, small or large book, in almost every single stock we traded, unless we had a view, in which case we would have a large position in it.
Okie dokie. Thank you for that.
Did you ever have, I've always been fascinated by market making as a concept, because today I when I started investing, 16 years ago or whatever it was, you got computerized trading. So you could log on to a broker, you clicked a button, it gave you a quote within 30 seconds, and you could buy it, and the shares were in your account really within almost 5 minutes. Now it's even faster than that. It's almost instantaneous. Presumably, if you go back in time, that process gets slower and slower and slower. And so, you know, I, as the customer, would call my broker. That might take me, I don't know, 5 minutes to get through to them. They then have to call you and go, right, Henry wants to buy 5,000 shares of Acme. What's the price? Was it more typical that the broker, would the broker quote the customer the price and tell you what they wanted, or would they have to call you and get the price?
Well, it very much depended on our relationship with the broker. But so back then, prices were quote driven. So we had something called SEAC, which stands for Stock Exchange Automated Quote System. So it was a screen where we would input prices, we would display the prices, and that was what was called a quote driven system. So if we go back to this imaginary stock, Acme, if we were the best buyer at 211 and Barclays were a seller at 212, the price would show 211 to 212. And as soon as we answered a phone, we were committed to dealing at the price that we were showing on that screen. So gotcha. What would inevitably happen in busy times, the phone starts ringing. I know this sounds far from ideal, but it's the way it was. The phone rings, you start looking at all your prices to make sure that you're not caught napping or out of line in anything. So you'd answer the phone, in which case it could be someone like Barclays doing what was called a challenge, which is an intermarket maker trade, or it could be a stockbroker who would either say, can I have I see you showing 211 or 213 and Acme, can I sell you 5,000 shares? We book it. Or it would be a friendly stockbroker, say something like, I'm a seller of 5,000 Acme, can you improve? In which case we would inevitably try. So as for the end user, the stockbroker at the time was all important, because their relationship with the market maker was what determined the price that the client got.
Yeah. So was it possible that you ended up with a position where, let's say there were a load of sellers in the market of a load of shares, let's say Vodafone, because Vodafone's just had a profit warning and nobody wants Vodafone anymore. So all the brokers would call you up and go, right, we want to sell at whatever price you've just quoted. Was it possible that you then couldn't find a buyer? How do you manage the matching?
Massively. So what we would do is you have to take a view on what you think the right price is. So Profits warning would come out before the market opens. Occasionally, something dramatic would happen during market hours. The idea was that the market would find its own level during trading hours. So the idea was that you had to get the stock to the right price straight away. That's why a stock would suddenly move from 210 to 180, because there's no point. In fact, it's financial suicide to buy stock all the way down to 210, 208, 206, 204, all the way down to where it should be, which you think is 180. If, as a market maker, and you have to have the courage of your convictions, if you believe it is 180, you've got to get that price in there straight away, because you do not want to buy stock on the way down. So the idea is you discourage sellers from basically selling at the wrong price, and you want to find the buyers. So that's the way that would work.
Gotcha. So you're constantly adjusting your price, and you're trying to move, you know, really preempt what your buyers and sellers want.
Yeah, and of course, if you overestimated the damage that a statement may bring, i.e., they're not 180, they're really 195. Yet you've marked them all the way down to 180, and you find buyers. That's your financial loss. So it kind of encourages you to. Yeah. Can't become very good at trying to estimate where the first price should be.
Gotcha.
I love that bit there, Wayne, because often Henry and I see a profit warning and we go, ouch, and we're looking at it, and occasionally as well we actually own that, and we're like, okay, do we sell it immediately or not? And we see the price just going down 5, down 10, down 15, and it just to the point where I'm often going, I'm not going to take this pain anymore. This profit warning is actually one that's structurally impaired the company for a good 6 months, so I'm not going to wait. And I go at that point now where it's 15% down, and I go, right, okay, I'll take the hit, I'm going to move on. It's hit 15% down, and then suddenly, as soon as I've hit that, it's almost as if, you know, like you say, people are watching me. I've hit the sell button, I've gone, oh, what a relief. I see it go down to 16%, 17%, and then before I'll blink again, and I come back in the afternoon, it's up 5%. What happens there? Did the market makers get the prices wrong, or did were there some willing buyers that were actually waiting for that price point to go, right, let's buy that by the shed load?
So the stock market. So I mean, I've got a couple of very strong views on this. The first is that it's incredible how we all seem to have the same point of inflection. Everybody say panics, but basically panics at the same point, and it's just
capitulation. Yeah.
I've never understood it, but everyone has that same pain point. It's almost like everyone's got the same position at the same price, and they look. It's quite incredible. And the other thing, so here's something I worked out when I was at Rothschild as well, watching the price of gold. I've realised that I came up with this analogy, and of course they thought I was mad, but I think it still stands true. I used to think there was a guy in Switzerland with a lever marked. It said gold, and he had nothing but lever which went gold price up, gold price down, and he would move that lever in whichever way would cause the most pain. I.e., if everybody was long of gold, he would pull the lever and the price would go down, which is exactly what happens, because when everybody's long, who's going to buy it? It goes down.
Yes.
So unfortunately, I think with profits forming, it's very much like that. Everybody gets out at the bottom, and as soon as that stops, guess what? The bars come in, and the people who had held it very rarely go back in, because they don't want to. I think it's
feel
a
the pain again. Problem of,
yeah, they don't want to feel foolish internally. So,
yeah.
Are we frozen again?
No, don't worry about us freezing, mate. We'll just carry on. But I love that. I love that response.
Oh, sorry. So
one of the things I want to ask then, because obviously now you've had your 38 years in the market, and invariably you're doing a bit of trading, but you must be also have invested over the long term. So what has changed regarding your investing mindset from when you're in your 20s and 30s to where you are now, you know, with 38 years experience in the markets?
So, I mean, things I've learned are, I mean, certainly for things like profits warning, things like that. I mean, there's a number of adages, and, you know, if you guys are happy to have me back, I'll be happy to talk about a few of these at another stage. But, you know, it's better to travel than to arrive. It's such a valid concept for the stock market, because if everyone's expecting a company's nudging forecasts up from the analysts, and everyone's expecting great things from this company, and they come out with great things, guess what happens? Price goes down because they've done what was expected. You know, you've traveled, so that's that. You get out straight away because it's as good as it's going to get. So that's one concept. The other concept, which has taken me longer to learn, is there is no point having money in a company that's an innovator, because like Apple have worked out, being first counts for nothing. You know, everything Apple have done has been basically following someone else's idea. So the whole graphical user interface that Macs run on was, I think, developed by Xerox, you know, 50 years ago. I'm thinking what else? The mobile phones, they weren't the first. You know, your Nokia. I remember buying a Sony Ericsson phone in 2003 that had a touch screen, and Apple came in 5 years later. So Apple tend to wait till they see where the market is, and then innovate from there. So, you know, I've lost money in companies making quantum dots for TVs, graphene, a company who graphene, a fuel cell company. These companies, great ideas, but in the UK, we don't have the investing universe that these companies can find enough money to keep innovating. So as an investor, I think I would rather go for a company that's established and following on from someone else than the company that's come out with a great creation. Because if you look at intelligent energy, they've gone bust. If you look at graphene, I can't remember the name of the company. There was a graphene company invested in the quantum dots company. I think they've gone bust.
Was that one run by, I can't remember what his name was now, was it Vissarion?
No, that I think he was
What?
talking about Nanako. I think it was
Nanako, that Nanako were the
Nanako, yeah,
quantum
Nanako.
dot makers. Yeah, they're forever going to sell. I don't even know if they're still quoted. They were going to
I
sell
don't
their
even know if
quantum
it's still quite,
dots
but
to.
I remember that story, and it was all about in the TV is going to make the picture so crystal clear and it's going to be everywhere. And I was like, oh. And it did capture the market for a little while, the market's attention, and the company did quite well. But then it never ever got taken up by the
No,
large
no.
television makers
It
and so
is
on and so
still
forth.
listed.
Is it?
It's actually
Wow.
down 10% today. It's down
No, knowing
70.
that we were going to talk about it.
It's down 70% over the last 6 months, and it's down 87% over the last 5 years. So,
Right. So what's the market cap, Henry, of that company now? Because it's been around for years.
it is 4.8 million.
Well,
I
there you
would
go.
suggest that. That was going to be £1 billion
Sorry, I was
pound
going to say,
company
I
at one
think quantum
stage.
dots have had. And I think quantum dots have made it into TVs. I think they've moved on from there. Another great example is intelligent energy. You guys know what fuel cells do. I actually went up to Loughborough to visit them. This was after I left Deutsche Bank. I was trading and investing for myself. I traded AFC, ITM. You know, I thought I understood the fuel cell market. I've gone up to Loughborough to see intelligent energy, and there's this amazing, in a reception, they've got a glass Perspex cube, probably 3 meters by 3 meters. In it is this massive engine, and this massive engine is working on oxygen, and the output is water, which is coming into a cup. And I'm looking at this thinking, this is unbelievable. And the officers are fantastic. What I failed to realize was that A, they were probably still too early, and B, they spent more money on that glass cube in their reception with the engine in than they actually took over the next 2 years. So it's with the lack of accountants, forensic hindsight, trying to become a long-term investor as a trader is never a good idea. So that taught me that I need to be a trade, remain a trader, not an investor. Trader being in and out very quickly, you know, within a week, rather than having a long-term economic trend that I'm trying to buck.
I think that's really, really valid, Wayne. And I mean, this leads into quite nicely one of the other questions I've got for you. So you've got nearly 40 years, let's call it 40 years, FX in March. Market. Presumably, you've had some pretty shrewd teachers, and you've developed some pretty intelligent habits over the years. What habits do you think you, as a professional trader, have got that some of our audience might benefit from
Well,
adopting?
I learned a while ago. I mean, leaving the cozy confines of an investment bank, I had to develop my own trading style. So you need to have your own trading style. I mean, it's things that, how to put it, learning that the market doesn't see it personally. The market is not out to get you, me or Peter, whoever. It's not personal, and I think it's very easy for someone to throw their phone in the air, kick their little shoes heels up in the air, throw their toys out the pram, and say, "I hate the market. It screwed me today." But it doesn't. The market, it is obviously the summation of everybody's thoughts and trades and ideas. Whilst it may feel like a living entity, it's nothing personal. I think a lot of people find that hard. They just find it as like, it was out to get me. I was never going to make money today. But of course, it's not there. Rather sad. It's probably about the only takeaway I've got. I mean, as I said, there are a number of stock exchange adages such as buy on rumor, sell on fact, which is what market makers rely on. There's a rumor of a bid for X, Y, and Z, and it comes out, sell it straight away because it's all in the price, which is pretty much better to travel than to arrive, I think, just in a party frock.
Yeah, and I've noticed Peter does this a lot. I mean, I don't know how much you've followed Peter's sort of investing history, but he's absolutely notorious for takeovers. You can't blink without one of Peter's companies having another takeover offer from somewhere in the world. But rather than sitting and waiting around for these things to get signed and sealed and having it all fall through, Peter will usually take money off the table as soon as the takeover is announced. Go, you know what? You guys sort it out between yourselves. I'll have my 20%, 30%, 60%. Thank you very much.
I agree with that 100%. You've got to leave something on the table for the next man, because I mean, here's another thing that we've learned as traders, as market makers. Obviously, nobody knows when something's at the peak, but if you imagine that everybody knew that that price there is the high, if you want to sell at the high, who's going to buy it? Because if there's nothing left, so whilst it's not a universal concept, but this is the high, it applies more to takeovers than anything else. You have to leave something for someone else who buys it to make money, otherwise they're not going to buy it. So I'm with Peter 100%. Take your money and move on. You may squeeze a little bit more out of it, but it's not often worth the hassle. If the stock's suspended, it becomes take the money and run 100%.
Yeah, I think there has been occasions when I've had a stock and I've tried to squeeze too much out of it, and it's been less than, it's probably been just a touch over 10% from where the deal's going to be executed because it's not all cash. And invariably, it's dragged on, it's dragged on. They've had extensions after extensions. And then you get the worst news possible, which is the bid's off. And rather than taking that sub 11%, you've ended up with the share price just caving in back almost to where it started, and you're down 30% on the stock.
Worse than that, psychologically, you've now undermined your own confidence because your initial idea was,
Absolutely.
I should have done that, and you've ignored it to try
Psychology.
and make more. I think that is so important. You do not want to start effectively causing yourself to doubt yourself. You have to believe in
Absolutely.
what you do, otherwise inevitably you end up paralyzed by indecision, unable to trade. So again, I'm with you 100%. Get out, take the money, don't even look back, move on.
Right, I'm gonna ask something that's present now, that's going on right now, okay?
Oh,
And I've
God.
got this from on X, which is where I spend most of my time, unfortunately. So this was out this morning, and the statement was this: 25 best performing Russell 1000 stocks in the first half of the year. The best 25 of Russell 1000 stocks, okay? We're down an average of 25.4% in July as of yesterday. All 25 were down at least 8% during the month, yeah, month to date to what was the 20th yesterday. And of those best performing stocks, they included, and everyone was all over this, chasing this, these momentum stocks. You had SanDisk, which was all about memory, that everyone knows about. Yeah. Applied Otto, Micron, Intel, Western Digital, Marvel, Bloom Energy, Vicor, Dell, Digital Ocean, Iridium, Corning, and so on and so on and so on and so forth. And of course, SpaceX. SanDisk was down month to date to the 20th, 37%. But still, from the first half of the year, it was up 857%. So everyone was chasing that, but it's fallen back 37%. What can you explain regarding the trader that gets the investors and the traders tied up and wrapped up in FOMO of chasing the biggest winners and the tail? What it catches us all out, Wayne. I need somebody of your expertise to help me out and our listeners how to avoid.
I can try that.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEATS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe today using the TWINPEATS promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit shareScope.co.uk for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
As you say, the fear of missing out is huge. And I think that, so it was Warren Buffett who said that the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay sovereign. And I think that is the most relevant, most important one liner that anyone can have, because it doesn't matter if you're right. You could have the strongest courage of your conviction, but the market doesn't care. And the market, if it's in one of these ridiculous momentum runs that we have to own this or we have to sell this, you will get wiped out before it comes right. And I think for an awful lot of these, AI stocks, it's going to happen, because the cost of getting into AI is going to become cheap. I was only reading today about, they call him the baby face. This Chinese guy is worth $1.4 billion. He's 33 and he looks like he's seven or something. You know, and I believe there was something fairly similar a couple of months back. There was a Chinese company that found a way to create AI programs without the need to have the hugely expensive NVIDIA chipsets. It will happen, and the valuation of these companies will fall. But I've always thought that all this great innovation in, sorry, my pen's leaking. I've always thought this great innovation in the market, it always comes from America. And if anybody's ever asked me over the last 5 years where I think they should be, and I've always said I would be in American stocks, American tech stocks, because Apple ultimately is still going to do well. I'm not sure I'd want to be in NVIDIA now, but AMD chip makers, they're still, I'm not sure I'd want to be in Seagate. SanDisk, once they're up 800% still. But, I would rather have been SanDisk than Vodafone. But that's my personal view.
With SanDisk only 18 months ago, it had been written off. It had been literally written off, and it went up 20-fold. So, you know, just about when do you say that this Phoenix is going to rise again regarding some of these stocks?
As we just said,
$1 trillion stock becomes a $4 trillion stock.
But as we just said, the market stays rational longer than you can stay solvent. Yeah. So if you bought SanDisk before the rise, thinking there has to, you know, the fact memory is getting cheaper, whether it's internal, whether it's SSDs or whether it's portable memory sticks, it's getting cheaper. There will be more demand for it, but the price could have been pushed down for months afterwards. So, one of the cats. So once again, it's that whole, the market can stay rational longer than I can stay solvent.
Okay. Well, Henry, sorry. Just trying to get that question out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're spot on there. And I mean, It's interesting hearing you discussing AI shares because presumably you had similar sort of hypes back in the 80s, the 90s. I mean, I've heard about the dot-com bubble. I wasn't, investing at the time. What do you think our generation or the current generation of traders in the city is getting wrong that you feel like you guys learned all those years ago? Do you think there's anything obvious that we're missing?
Well, again, we're going back to the you can stay solvent. Sorry, the markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. When I think back to the tech boom of 1999, 2000, the price moves we saw in tech stocks was ridiculous. At the time, it's very easy to just get caught up in it because we had buyer A, warm buyer B. We had to be long. These were stocks that basically had nothing. They had nothing other than an idea. That, from what I remember, there was. Oh, I used to sit next to the guy who was quoting the tech stocks. I was at Carmel Benson. I remember that some of the companies they were floating an idea, which, with the benefit of hindsight, could it ever go right? They would float £1 and they would go to £1.80 on the first day because Jonathan Casper Agnew Smith, I whatever, who was involved with the previous internet stock, was involved with this stock. And it's the extraordinary madness of crowds. And there's a very good book, which I think if you guys haven't read, called the, I think it's called Popular Delusions and the Extraordinary Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay.
Got a
Which
very good book.
very good book.
Excellent
And
book.
if anybody else is interested, I think the other great book to read in the stock market is Reminiscences of a Stock Operator by
Now,
Edwin Lefebvre. And those two books, I think, are the
got
cornerstone
those
for
marked.
anyone.
Yeah.
I would hope so. And
So
they're great books and they're relevant still today, both of them.
they are very, very relevant.
Reminiscences
I
you can
think
actually
I
get
think
for a few pounds. It's incredibly cheap. And if there's anybody listening that hasn't read it, go and get a copy because it's written by a guy that was trading over 100 years ago, near enough. And it goes through, it shares so many stories, and you think if you didn't know he was writing 100 years ago, this could be today. He makes a fortune, he loses it, he makes it back, he goes through the psychology of it, the characters that he met on the stock exchange. Absolutely And
brilliant. You can pick it up for a few pounds, so go get a copy.
definitely, do you know what happened to him?
No,
He
actually.
committed suicide.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah. So there.
That's the difficulty of markets, isn't it?
It's a difficulty. I think it's very often the difficulty of having had money and all of a sudden you haven't got it. It kind of goes back to the whole kind of psychologically undermining yourself. You think, well, why did I screw up when the guy who was a junior on the floor is now riding around in whatever was considered to be the top of the range car then.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
that, unfortunately, is the downside of markets, that there's always someone doing better than you. And if you're not kind of mentally robust, it can affect you. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, Wayne, what I'm going to do now is have a little mini break, but I'm going to continue the conversation afterwards. What I want to get to after I've spoken about the Investor Summit is talk about your blog and some of the stories that you're going to share with us before we close this off. I'm going to talk about the Investor Summit. I'm hoping that you're going to be there on the 18th, but I think you said you're going to be away on
It's a
a
Friday, isn't
wedding.
it? Yeah,
You're going to be at a
my
wedding.
wedding
So you're
in
going to have to tell
Palmer.
all your trader friends and city folk to come with us. So, as I said before, folks, Investor Summit on the 18th of September, the brewery, Chiswell Street, London. We've got keynote speakers. We're delighted to welcome the Right Honourable Sir Mel Stride, the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, is going to be opening keynote. And we've also got Lucy Castledean, the Director of Consumer Investments from the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, and she will be speaking as well as our other keynote. And other speakers we have got on the day include, and not fully the full list, is Ben Rogoff, Lead Manager of Polar Capital Technology Trust, Dr. George Cooper, who you know as a guest has been on this show, the founder and CIO of Equitile Investments,
We've got Laura Fall, co-fund manager of Lord Adventure, George Barrow, fund manager at Polar Capital, and he's in the fund manager for Capital Global Financials Trust. We've got Tao On Young, the director of Vietnam Enterprise Investment Trust, Stuart Widdowson, I'm sure Wayne will know this particular person, founder and managing director of Odison Capital, James Deal, co-CEO of Retail Book, Stacey Parson, managing director of Retail Book, Micah Curry, VP of Personal Finance at Pension B, Pippa Dale, DCM banking side of London Stock Exchange Group, Nick Dillsworth of Retail Book. We've got Jeff Pressridge emceeing and doing a few bits with us on the main stage, and he's the editor at large at the Mail on Sunday. Annabelle Brody-Smith, the communications director of the AIC. Nick Britton, research and content director at the AIC. We've got Andrew Van Sickle, the editor of Money Week. Simon French, chief economist and head of research at Panmure Liberum. We've got Tom Bailey, head of research at Han ETF. Got Dr. Jeremy Skillington, CEO of Poolbeg Pharma. We've got Cecilia Williams of ComputerShare, and many, 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 many more. Our media partners include Master Investor Show, Money Week, ShareSock, ShareScope, London Investor Show, and some more coming on board as we speak. So our main sponsors, as I said before, now include an additional one, which is Retail Book, Equitable Investments, and Pension B. So we're going to have a full day, three tracks of content, refreshments throughout the day, lunch and a meal at the end, and a bar at the end as well, all in the ticket. So please go and visit us on our website, which is www.investorsummit.co.uk/tickets. And we will look forward to seeing you there. Wayne, if you were available, who would you have wanted to see from that quick list that I just ran there? Who would you have been wanting to see?
What about from the quick list? I would have loved to have seen it. Edwin Lefebvre, who wrote Reminiscences of a Stock Orator. Who would I've liked to see? Well, I know Stacey Parsons. The rest, fund managers operate in a kind of a different level, obviously, to traders and investors, because they take a longer term view. So I've long found that fund managers, you know, they're almost like a kind of different level of intellect to a trader, in as much as they take a much longer term view, and they have the pockets, which is their, that have the bigger pockets to actually sit through losses, because whereas most traders buy something, it goes down, they cut it and move on. If a fund manager buys something, it goes down, he'll buy more. It's almost
conviction.
Absolutely. It's quite a list. Probably Jeff Presswich, whose stories have basically made and broken a lot of traders over the last 20, 30 years from the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah, he's an absolute phenomenon. I rang him and spoke to him and went on the knee, and I was like, please, 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 Jeff. And he's like, all right, Peter, I love you. I'll do it. So I'm thrilled he's involved. It's a fantastic individual. Been at it for so many years, knows everybody in the city. So for him to come and grace us with his presence.
I think it's fantastic. And that sounds literally, I mean, obviously I have no interest in whatsoever, but that sounds like a phenomenal attendance list of speakers you have there. So I'm almost thinking about not going to my son's wedding and coming to this instead.
Thank you very much. Now, Wayne, we are going to talk. I know this is a bit like Henry's been chomping at the bit at, right? It's a talk about Tales from the Trading Floor, right? Your personal blog, you're sharing some of the stories, you're sharing some of the journeys, sharing some of your adventures. I'm going to call them adventures because they are just that. And some of the things that you've learned from the trading floor. So for those that haven't visited yet, the Substack is at talesfromthetradingfloor, all one word, .substack.com. Yeah, so www.talesfromthetradingfloor.substack.com. Now, we've got, I would say, 15 minutes-ish, Wayne, but I want you to just run through at least two stories that are going to get people going, wow. Yeah? And I know Andrew's going to sit there with his jaws open, so you can say whatever you want, other than swearing, obviously. Don't want to swear too much. to share two choice stories, mate, that we're going to go, we're just going to sit back and go, please, yeah.
Okay, so there is, okay, one general story is the fact that the city was fueled by alcohol throughout the 80s and 90s. So UBS, and I'm sure I'm going to have somebody moaning at me tomorrow for saying this, at UBS, you know, it was fairly high pressure just after Big Bang. We had the, you know, had Black Monday, you know, a fairly turbulent couple of years. Every Friday night, we would go to William Barrows or Gals to have a drink. And basically, it was speed drinking on a Friday night for 2 hours. I get out of there, try to work out how to get home in a shocking state and somehow retain my marriage. And what would happen is that if you didn't drink, after a couple of goes, you weren't invited out because, you know, there's the market-making team, 30 guys, and one person who's ordering lemonade every time. So the guy ordering lemonade every time stopped getting invited out. What would happen is that every March, there would be a round of redundancies. And, of course, who were the first to get made redundant? Those that didn't fit in with the team. It was those that didn't drink. And I always used to joke, and obviously nobody ever said this, that, you know, on their exit interview, it'd be something along the lines of, you know, I'm really sorry, we have to let you go. You unfortunately don't have the capacity for alcohol that we need as a trader. But should you ever develop the capacity to drink a bottle of wine, come back to the desk and make it look like you're doing your job, please feel free to reapply for your job. Okay, nobody ever said that. But it felt like it was that implicit, the connection between drinking and having a job. And here's one of the crazy things. We were encouraged to go out with the stockbrokers, and we had something called interdealer brokers, who were the connectors between professional traders. And these lunches involved alcohol, obviously. And we had to go back to the office after lunch. If we didn't go back, we lost a day's holiday. So if you think about that, judge with the morals of today, the fact that we were encouraged to go back after drinking too much and sit behind a desk with millions of pounds of the bank's money at risk, look madness, but that's the way it was. That one. Another one was, I think it's probably too complex for a short story, but Dimension Data, which when it went into the index, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of what happened when it went in. Dimension Data, no. I'll try and... Okay, so Dimension Data was a South African company listed in 2000. They already had a listing in Johannesburg. They were, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, they were worth about £3 billion. They've listed on the London Stock Exchange, I think in July, and it's, you know, everyone's realised that come the FTSE reweighting in September, I think it was, they would go straight into the FTSE. You know, it wasn't close. I don't know how much you know about the reweighting and the index.
Yeah, but, we know about that. Yeah, and okay, promotion and emotions. Yeah.
So like it used to be anywhere, any stock, as long as if it dropped out of the top 100, if it's still below, I think it's 103 or 105, it didn't lose its place. Once it went below 105, on ranking of capital, it was out. Yeah. Anyway, so Dye Data was due to go in, and then the index funds didn't really have any leeway on how and when they bought the stock. So all the index tracker funds knew that they needed to buy, and I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to guess it's something like 200 or 300 million shares had to be bought on the closing price the day before they went into the index. So what happened was, and I know at least three houses who did this, I would imagine all of them, instead of being paid commission by a client for our order, we paid them to give us the order. So if you imagine, if you've got an order to buy 100 million or something, you are going to make that price go wherever you want it to go. So I don't want to say anyone did this, but if I paid a client £5 million for an order and I had 100 million shares to buy, I would probably buy, let's say, 30 million badly throughout the afternoon, 30 million on the closing auction, and then short the other 40 million. And lo and behold, that's pretty much what happened. And I think Dimension Data went from £5.60 at 4:30 to a closing auction price of £10.20, I think it was. They've gone up. They've gone up. They've gone up £4 something in five trading minutes because any auction, and then the next day, which was the Monday, I think it was, £5.60. So they've made and lost something like £3 billion in a matter of minutes. It was possibly the most extreme trading situation on
that would probably turn me to drink city. If I wasn't already there.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, that.
For those of the audience that are having little what's the word I'm looking for? The not alarm bells. Anyway, it'll come back to me. This will remind you of a book by Geraint Anderson, which was written about 15 years ago, I think, called City Boy.
I think I worked with him. He was an analyst, wasn't he? I think he was a... I mean, I remember him, yeah. He was a clown once.
So he wrote this book called City Boy, which I think was my first introduction to life in the city of London as such. Which basically, he was a bit of a layabout by his own accounts. And his older brother, I think it was, eventually said, well, you really ought to get a job because, you know, you can't stay on my sofa for free forever. And got him a job as an analyst, I think, in the utilities sector or the telco sector, one or the other. And he was bored to death and he knew absolutely nothing about finance. And basically, the only qualification he seemed to need at the time was the ability to drink vast quantities of alcohol and act like an absolute miscreant. And he then goes on through this book for the next 20 years of his career, getting into gradually more and more wild and wacky adventures. Very much worth reading. But when I saw your blog, I thought, you know, there's some echoes of this in here. It seems more civilized. But yeah, certainly is enjoyable to read. So where can we find your blog, Wayne?
Well, at the moment, it's certainly on LinkedIn. LinkedIn under the hashtag Tales from the Trading Floor. And as Peter mentioned, on Substack, Tales from the Trading Floor.
Tales from the Trading Floor.
Free, please subscribe. Not that I'm using it for anything, but at least it's kind of nice to know how many people are reading it. And we'll keep pushing those stories out there.
Excellent.
Brilliant, Wayne. Going to ask you some final questions now regarding the general melee of the markets and getting your perspective, because you're looking at the markets all the while as a trader mainly, but also regarding your work so you can look after your clients. What is your current thoughts regarding the most misunderstood aspect by investors regarding investing? What do you think they misunderstand? What do they get wrong most often?
They're capitalized. I think falling in love with a position is a huge, huge problem for a lot of people. Again, this goes back to the psychology. It's almost as if you can imagine yourself as a poker player, you want to view every hand objectively. And what happens, I think, to investors is it's known as cognitive bias, that they buy a stock. It doesn't matter whether it came from the guy who works down their local garage or whatever, or one of their mates, or they worked it out themselves. They buy a stock, and then everything they read, the brain, it's human nature, the brain interprets it as positive. So, and if not that, they then think, well, everyone else is wrong, I'm right, because you are so in love with that stock. You only see the good things.
Anchoring bias. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it tends to end in tears, unfortunately. So that's a big, big thing for anyone to try to avoid. But of course, it's easier said than done.
Absolutely. Emily, have you got a final question for Wayne, please?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one easy one, but what do you think the biggest myth about professional traders is that's just not true? What do you think people think it's like and it's not?
That they're sharks and they always make money. Trust me, we don't. Trust me on that.
Certainly not after six bottles of wine.
I think a bottle each was probably the maximum, but yeah. As I said, I think that's it. The professional traders know what they're doing. They always make money. And like I said, we definitely don't.
Right. Wayne, is there anything you want to conclude with? Because we're going to wrap this up. You've been absolutely phenomenal. It's been fantastic to have you on here.
I've actually enjoyed this. It's kind of cathartic. I would love to come back. I mean, maybe we can run through some of the old adages that we used to have on the stock exchange floor. Quite happy to run through some more of my tales from the trading floor logs. And as I said, if anybody's out there wants to read more, Substack Tales from the Trading Floor.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you ever so
Thank
much,
you sir. Very much both for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
No, it's been brilliant having you, sir. So, ladies and gents, that was Wayne Grossman, 38 years financial services expertise. It's covered everything, trading, FX, commodities, etc. Working for Winslow Tax Law Limited at the moment and doing his own investing and trading. So please find him on LinkedIn and please visit talesfromthetradingfloor.substack.com and we'll hopefully have Wayne back on here for you, ladies and gents, after the summer and after a big, big wedding, I think he's going to in September.
Absolutely. So and Wayne, after your investor summit, but if I go, absolutely. As opposed to going to your investor summit, which I'm now thinking that may well be worth, you know what? I'm sure my son will forgive me at some stage.
And don't. He won't forgive me. Oh, Wayne, it's been absolutely
Peter,
delight
Henry,
having you on here, sir.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll definitely catch up very, very soon. I'm just going to stop this and then we'll carry on, have a quick chat and then we'll go. But ladies and gents, we'll see you in 2 weeks' time and we'll speak soon. We'll look forward to having some feedback regarding this particular pod and take care and God bless you all.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.